Okay, welcome to English 307, Survey of American Literature from Origins of the Civil War. Today we will be talking about Henry David Thoreau as part of our Transcendentalist unit. And I'm not going to spend too much time on Thoreau's biography. You can find informational stuff about that online, of course. It should be mentioned that Thoreau is, well, his dates are 1817 to 1862. He dies without seeing the Civil War. And he is a champion of abolition, particularly in the late 1840s into the 1850s, and a supporter of self-styled Puritan and insurrectionist, or would-be insurrectionist, John Brown. Thoreau is also a friend of Emerson's, and they have a kind of a lifelong or lasting friendship and correspondence. And certainly, in a lot of ways, you know, Thoreau, like Whitman, is often thought of as a kind of descendant of Emerson. And you'll see, when you read them, you'll see similarities. As much as there are differences, you will see the similarities in their language and their sensibility, their philosophy, some of their themes. And I want to, so today we're focusing on Thoreau's most popular work is Walden, which he started to deliver as a series of lectures. But we're going to focus on the work Civil Disobedience, which is probably his other most famous work, certainly in terms of political philosophy. We're kind of beginning. I uploaded to our course Blackboard an essay that I think will make a good kind of proviso about how to read Thoreau. And it's a provocative essay by Catherine Schultz called The Moral Judgments of Henry David Thoreau. It's often, the subtitle is Why, Given Its Fabrications, she's referring to Walden, Inconsistencies and Myopia, Do We Continue to Cherish Walden and Thoreau? The essay is often also referred to as Pond Scum. So I want to just quote briefly, because I think, I assume that, Scholes intended to read Thoreau, or she reads Thoreau this way. So I take her at her word. But I think that the way that she reads Thoreau kind of is often, it represents a way that many readers do respond to him, which is a kind of literal reading of him, not looking for something that I would call, that I want to emphasize in the way that we look at Thoreau and think about him as Thoreau's use of ironic dislocation, which is to say that he often takes terms and uses them, he tropes them, meaning he turns the phrase or turns the meaning or changes the meaning of a word or a concept in ways that that are very, that rely heavily on irony. And that irony becomes dislocating in the sense that it gives the reader a sense of a new meaning, opening up a new meaning for the possibility of that context. But often that new meaning is contingent on a kind of irony. And if you don't read Thoreau, if you read Thoreau absent of irony, you get a very different Thoreau. And I'll give you an example from the Scholes essay. This is at the very beginning. We won't spend much time on this, but I'll just read this briefly. At the very beginning, she writes, "On the evening of October 6th, 1849, the 120 people aboard the brig St. John threw a party. The St. John was a so-called famine ship, Boston-bound from Galway. It was filled with passengers fleeing the mass starvation then devastating Ireland. They had been at sea for a month. Now, with less than a day's sail remaining, they celebrated the imminent end of their journey, and they hoped the beginning of a better life in America. Early the next morning, The ship was caught in a nor'easter, driven toward shore and dashed upon the rocks just outside Cohasset Harbor. Those on deck were swept overboard, those below deck drowned when the hull smashed open. Within an hour, the ship had broken up entirely. All but 9 crew members and roughly a dozen passengers perished. 2 days later, a 32-year-old Massachusetts native en route from Concord to Cape Cod, and so here Schultz is talking about, she segues into talking about Walden for this essay, but she begins with a work by Thoreau called Cape Cod. Thoreau gets word of the disaster and detoured to Cohasset to see it for himself. When he arrived, fragments of the wreck were scattered across the strand. Those victims who had already washed ashore lay in rough wooden boxes. So she skips forward and says, the visitor from Concord surveying all this found himself unmoved. So this is what Thoreau says. On the whole, it was not so impressive a scene as I might have expected. If I had found one body cast upon the beach in some lonely place, it would have affected me more. I sympathized rather with the winds and waves, as if to toss and mangle these poor human bodies was the order of the day. If this was the law of nature, why waste any time in awe or pity? This impassive witness, Scholl says, also had stern words for those who, undone by the tragedy, could no longer enjoy strolling along the beach. Surely, he admonished, quote, its beauty was enhanced by wrecks like this, and it acquired thus a rarer and sublimer beauty still, end quote. So this is, she picks a shocking passage, and Cape Cod is quite shocking. And she uses that to sort of say that Thoreau, well, let's see, let's take it directly from her. She says, the real Thoreau was, in the fullest sense of the word, self-obsessed, narcissistic, fanatical about self-control, adamant that he required nothing beyond himself to understand and thrive in the world. From that inward fixation flowed a social and political vision that is deeply unsettling. It is true that Thoreau was an excellent naturalist and an eloquent and prescient voice for the preservation of wild places, but Walden is less a cornerstone work of environmental literature than the original Cabin Porn, a fantasy about rustic life divorced from the reality of living in the woods, and especially a fantasy about escaping the entanglements and responsibilities of living among other people. And so I think my point in drawing your attention to this essay, and I hope that you check it out, as a way of sort of thinking, as a provocation for thinking about Thoreau, but the reason why I draw attention to it is that all of it hinges on a certain reading of Thoreau that requires that you take him at his word, and that you don't read irony and what I am calling ironic dislocation in his work, and it requires that you don't read his use of language performatively. There's something that the literary critic Richard Poirier called the performative self, or the performing self, and that in American literature, and he finds this at work in authors like Emerson and like Thoreau, as well as American poets, which is the notion that he gets this notion from ultimately from philosophers like Judith Butler, or theorists like Judith Butler, who derive it from ordinary language philosophers like J.L. Austin. But it's this notion that language can, and rhetoric can perform in a way, that it can do things. And so that with the performative self, the author is not, or the language at work in the text is not meant to be taken as saying exactly what it means. That there's some kind of a distance between the speech itself and what its meaning is. Or you might think of this as a form of indirection. So we want to pay attention, when we read Thoreau, we want to pay attention to not the surface meaning of the language, or the most kind of literal meaning of the language, but what is the language, what kind of meaning is the language getting at that it's not saying directly, but is rather suggesting through its performative utterance. So we have that. Now, let us jump into civil disobedience. So this text is taken from the Library of America edition of Thoreau's works. So when I'm going to go through this and point to a couple of passages, I'll cite the page numbers, but the page numbers come from the PDF that I gave you, and that PDF is from the Library of America edition of Thoreau's works. So I want to sort of at the outset, I want to say something, or I want to suggest something to you in relation to the Schultz essay, which is that this essay by Thoreau, Civil Disobedience, is often, in my estimation, misread as an essay about an anti-government essay, or an essay about limited government or small government. That is to say that it's seen as a kind of cranky, curmudgeonly work about that advocates some kind of anarchism or a libertarianism. What I would sort of put to you instead is that the essay is really about moral failure, or a feeling of moral failure in democratic societies, in particular in America, in the context of slavery more broadly, but also the Mexican-American War more particularly. And the Mexican-American War, just which Thoreau references in the essay, it goes from 1846 to 1848, and it is understood by a lot of historians now. You know, there's a lot of myths surrounding it, like a lot of American settler colonial history, but historians now really understand it as an imperialist war that was it came after America had annexed Texas, which was a disputed territory, but essentially America took Texas and then fought Mexico to expand its territory westward under the sort of logic of manifest destiny. And so many understood it, or at least some understood it, critics understood it as an attempt to spread slavery westward, and saw it as a war of aggression and imperialism. None other than the general and then U.S. President Ulysses S. Grant, for example, described it as the most evil war that he had ever seen. And he said it was an evil war because the United States was a stronger, in his words, a stronger nation fighting a weaker nation for territory. So that's kind of some of the historical context that's at play here. So let's take a look at the essay. So maybe we could look at the first passage. Thoreau writes, "I heartily accept the motto that government is best which governs least, and I should like to see it acted up to more rapidly and systematically. Carried out, it finally amounts to this, which I also believe, that government is best which governs not at all. And when men are prepared for it, that will be the kind of government which they will have." And then he says, towards the bottom of the first paragraph, "The government itself, which is only the mode which the people have chosen to execute their will, is equally liable to be abused and perverted before the people can act through it. Witness the present Mexican-American, the Mexican War," which is referring to the Mexican-American War, "the work of comparatively a few individuals using the standing government as their tool. For in the outset, the people would not have consented to this measure."